Well, good morning, Lake Cities. If you have your Bibles, I want you to turn into a couple of different places, Matthew chapter 5 and 1 John chapter 2. We're going to look at a couple of different verses as we dig into this continuing series on the Ten Commandments. I should say this at the front, happy Mother's Day. I was not real excited about teaching this text on Mother's Day. I thought about stopping down this series and picking something lighter, like Why All Moms Are Great. But this is the text that we've been given to deal with today. And it's the commandment of God to not commit adultery or to honor your marriage vows, to stay with the one you married. I love doing weddings. It's probably one of the most joyous things that I get to do as a minister. And I always love in the moment in the ceremony when the bride walks in and the groom sees her for the first time and just the look of astonishment and love. And in most of the ceremonies that I do, I give it a metaphor about God. I ask them to think of God as a craftsman, as an artisan, as someone who might sculpt or paint or write. And as somebody who agonizes over every word and every color and every shade and every contour of a sculpture, so God agonized over every part of creation. It even says that at the end of each day that he created, he stepped back and evaluated. He proofread his work. He checked it for errors. And do you notice that there's a rhythm in that retelling? And the rhythm is, and God saw that it was good. And I often point out in wedding ceremonies that God says all of these things were good except for one thing. It was not good for man to be alone. There's even this kind of comical interchange where God has Adam seek out all these different suitable helpers for him and none can be found. And so then he creates woman. And it's funny to me because the thought is, neither one of us were created to be alone. We were created to be in relationship with each other. Here's the example that I often give. It's like if you're imagine yourself sitting on a cliff, overlooking a beautiful beach, and the waves are crashing, and the sun is setting. Now imagine who you want to be with at that moment. Would you want to be with your significant other, or would you want to be with your dog? And some of you, I know, some of the men are thinking, well, that dog, he never asked me to talk about my feelings. We just hunt and fish together. He's a great companion. But the women are thinking, that dog never looks at his phone to see what the score is when I'm trying to talk to him. That dog is there for me. But God's design for our lives, he says it, that everything in creation is good except for us to be alone. And so this institution of marriage is created. And for God, the value of that institution is much higher than anywhere else in all of recorded history. That this commandment that's given in Exodus 20, verse 18, is a raising of the stakes, maybe even an overvaluing of a property, right? Of saying that what we treat as cheap and menial, and there's plenty of fish in the sea, and you know, women are like buses, there'll be another one if you miss this one. God says that's not true. God says your marriage vows are very important. I love this story. It was at the banquet of Tom and Susan's 50th wedding anniversary. And Tom was asked by his friends to give a speech, to count of all the benefits of marriage that over such a long duration. And tell us, Tom, what is it that you've learned all these wonderful years, these 50 years of marriage with your wife? And Tom responded, well, I've learned that marriage is the best teacher of all. It teaches you loyalty, forbearance, meekness, self-restraint, forgiveness, and a great many other qualities you wouldn't need to know if I just stayed single. Well, there's some truth to that, right? There are things that we need and learn in marriage that we can't learn or don't have to practice in other places. But that wasn't the case in the culture of Moses' time. And it certainly wasn't the case in the culture of Jesus' time. Marriage was little more than a legal arrangement. And all of the power rested in the man, the husband. and he could send his wife away and he could treat her like dirt. And so in these passages where God and Jesus talk about the value of marriage, the value of staying committed to your vows, hear again how precious you are, how important, how valuable your soul is. It's like last week when we talked about do not murder. Well, we don't get a scorecard out and check the yes box for I've never committed adultery. That's not to our credit, in other words. And so when God's saying do not commit adultery here, he's saying much more than just you need to make sure and not do that thing after you've said I do. What God is saying is that this vow that you take, this promise that you make, is eternal. It's to be kept for life. I love preacher stories. And by that, that's sometimes stories that aren't true, but are interesting. And then sometimes a preacher story is true and they're interesting. And sometimes a preacher's story is true and it's interesting and it's about a preacher. This one is about E.V. Hill. He's one of my favorite preachers of all time. You can actually find his sermons online. If you look for him on YouTube, you can find some of his sermons. An amazing, amazing communicator. But he tells this story of being young, a young preacher, and not having enough money. And so he decided to buy a service station, a filling station, a gas station is what we would call them. But his wife at the time did not think that this was a good idea. He didn't have any experience running a service station. What did he know about running a service station? And eventually, she was proved to be right. And Evie lost his shirt. He lost all of his money. And Evie called to tell her that. And his wife simply said, all right. Evie came home that night expecting his wife to be pouting over his investment. Instead, she sat down with him and said, I've been doing some figuring. I figure that if you don't smoke and you don't drink, and if you smoked and drank, you would have lost at least as much as you lost in that service station in paying for that smoking and that drinking. So it's six in one hand and a half dozen in the other. Let's just forget it. Shortly after the whole fiasco with the service station, E.V. came home one night and he found that his house was in completely dark. And when he opened the door, he saw his wife Jane there had prepared this beautiful candlelight meal. And he said with his humor, what meanest thou this, wife? And she said, well, we're going to eat by candlelight tonight. Evie thought it was a great idea. He tried unsuccessfully to turn on the light. And then he felt his way to the bedroom and he flipped another switch. The whole house was dark. And he finally figured out why the lights were off. The electricity had been shut off for non-payment. And his wife began to cry, and she said to him, you work so hard, and we're trying, but it's pretty rough, and I don't have enough money to pay the light bill, and I didn't want you to know about it, and so I just thought we could eat by candlelight. Dr. Hill described his wife's words with this. He says, she could have said, I've never been in this situation before. I was reared in the home of a doctor. We never had to want for anything. We never had our lights cut off. She could have broken my spirit. She could have ruined me. She could have demoralized me, but instead she said, somehow or another, we'll get these lights back on. Let's eat by candlelight tonight. So if you have your Bibles, turn to Matthew chapter 5, and we're going to read there starting in verse 27. You've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Now, you might read those two texts, do not commit adultery, and then what Jesus says on the Sermon on the Mount and say, those are really different texts, kind of inherently different. One seems to say that it's about your body, it's about what you do, and the other one says it's about your heart, it's about what you feel, it's about what you want or desire. One seems to be reasonable, rational, keepable. I can do this, I can not commit adultery, I can keep myself from doing. The other seems almost like it's such a high standard that it's impossible. It's like the cover of one of those fitness magazines. and you look at that model on there and you think, yeah, I think I could, but I also like to eat cake. I don't have that kind of willpower. So what do these two texts have in common, and why would I quote them at the same time? Because in both times, in both societies, in both cultures, these were uncommon words. These were words that were countercultural, that people would have said, what are you talking about? At the heart of the issue is your heart. Jesus is saying, it's not what you're doing with your body that's the problem. It's the sin that resides in your heart that leads to those things that you need to check. It's why last week we said, it's not just about not committing adultery, but about not just about not committing murder, killing somebody else. It's about valuing them and valuing their life and loving them in the way that Christ loved us. So if this is really more about sin than it is about keeping laws, then what's this sin? The sin is lust. And what's the heart? We said this when we talked about our Seven Deadly Sins series. We said that at the heart of every sin, at the beginning of every sin, is the sin of pride, of really wanting to be in control, of sitting on the throne where God only has the right to sit. It's why those first three commandments are so important. It's why he establishes that he is the one and true God. We're not to worship any other gods. We're not to make graven images, because he is the God who's in control. And then he says, if you're going to let me be in control, then do these things. Jesus raises the stakes. Jesus says, you've greatly undervalued what God has called precious. When God looks at his creation and says it's very good, that's one thing. But when he looks at us, he says that we're made in his image, that we bear the very image of God. And Jesus is right to raise the stakes. He's correct when he sets the price. His diagnosis is right on. The problem isn't getting your body to stop sinning. It's to get your heart to stop craving. I love how one writer, a guy by the name of Richard Exley, writes about lust. He says, lust is not the result of an overactive sex drive. It's not a biological phenomenon or the byproduct of our glands. If it were, then it could be satisfied, listen to this, with sexual experience. Like a glass of water quenches thirst or a good meal satisfies an appetite. But the more we attempt to appease our lust, the more demanding it becomes. There's simply not enough pornography in the world to satisfy lust's insatiable appetite. And when we deny our lustful obsessions, we're not representing a legitimate drive. We are putting to death an aberration. Lust is to the gift of sex what cancer is to a normal cell. Therefore, we deny it not in order to become sexless saints, but in order to become fully alive to God, which includes the full and uninhibited expression of our sexual being within the God-given covenant of marriage. Isn't that great? All the stuff that God made, God called good, he pronounced it good, and he pronounced that man and wife coming together as one is a good thing. I don't know if you've ever heard somebody say, that dessert is sinful. If I just look at that piece of cake, I'm going to gain 5 pounds, you know, that there's something inherent in the creation that is the problem. Well, desserts aren't sinful. I guess maybe if you baked it at the light of a full moon while chanting evil incantations, that might make it evil. But I don't think most of you do that. All these things that God made for us were intended to be gifts to us. And here's what's really interesting. All of God's gifts point back to him. All of God's gifts should make us realize how amazing and wonderful he is. It's why the beauty and the majesty of a sunset causes us to look back to the Creator. It's why holding a beautiful baby in our arms makes us wonder about the God who loves us enough to create life. Gifts should cause us to pause and acknowledge him. But too often, God's gifts become God's competition. And when God says, do not commit adultery, he says, you need to understand something. There is a competition, maybe even a war raging for your heart, for your allegiance. And one of the directions in which you're going to be pulled is to not stay faithful to the one you were married to. All of God's gifts become God's competition as we trade our love for the Creator for the worship of the creation. And then God has to compete for our affections with his own creations. 1 John chapter 2, I told you we'd get there. 1 John chapter 2, verse 1, we're going to go through 1 and 6. My dear children, I write this to you so that you will not sin, but if anybody does sin, we have an advocate for the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous one. He's the atoning sacrifice for our sins, and not only for ours, but also for the sins of the whole world. We know that we've come to know him if we keep his commands. Whoever says, I know him, but does not do what he commands is a liar, and the truth is not in that person. But if anyone obeys his word, love for God is truly made complete in them. This is how we know that we are in him. Whoever claims to live in him must live as Jesus did. Could it be said any more simply than that? To love God is to obey him, to live as Jesus did, to walk as Jesus walked. There's no such thing as a disobedient Christian. Obedience to God is a prerequisite in the relationship. We don't approach God as equals and say, Lord, you just tell me what you think and I'll give you a fair hearing and I'll weigh it and see if that's right. And some I'll take and some I need to go check out on my own. We come to God as our creator, as our maker, as our sustainer, and we say, whatever you say, that's what we will do. And he says, well, you can't say that you love God and not follow his commands. That verb keep there, it was used, the idea of a sentry who is walking his post. It means to keep a guard, a watch over your heart, to be careful. The verb's present tense, it indicates that it's something that we're going to keep doing. It's not a one-time decision that we make, but you're gonna have to keep a guard over your heart. I know that's difficult to do, it's easy to say, but obedience to God is an expression of our love for God. And our obedience to God should express itself in our love for others, for the people that he created. Oh, I never will forget, years and years ago, I was a young youth minister, and a new student had come in our midst. We were several ministries that would come together and do retreats and camps and mission trips. And so all the kids, even though they came from small churches, got to experience, you know, hundreds of kids at a time at these things. And of course, as teenagers do, any new people that come, if they're deemed to be cute or whatever word that you use to say somebody looks good, well, that was this young lady. And so there was this talk of this new student, even, I have to admit, among some of the youth ministers. And one youth minister said to the other youth minister, who she was in his youth group, he said, boy, that's got to be difficult. She is so pretty. How do you keep your attention where it should be? And I'll never forget my friend Andy. I love that he said this. He said, well, that girl came to our group as a friend of a friend who wanted to study the Bible, and we studied the word with her, and I baptized her, and I guess I just knew her as a soul first. It never dawned on me how pretty she was until all the guys started to notice. I knew her as a soul first. It takes a special kind of person to see people in that way, but that kind of person is a spirit-filled, spirit-led Christian. Timothy Keller captures this so well. He says, without the help of the Spirit, without a continual refilling of our soul's tank with the glory and love of the Lord, such submission to the interests of the other is virtually impossible to accomplish for any length of time. God's gifts becomes God's competition. And it's so true when it comes to lust. Keeping those marriage vows, honoring our spouses, keeping this commandment comes down to what we do with our heart and where we place the greatest interest. Sex is a gift from God. Sexual attraction, I believe, is a gift from God. And as a gift, it brings connection. But as a God to be worshiped, it brings loneliness. As a gift, sex can bring us pleasure in the confines of marriage, but as a God to be worshipped, it leads to emptiness. As a gift, it brings satisfaction. As a God, it brings slavery. As a gift, it brings intimacy. As a God, it brings separation. As a gift, it brings unity. But as a God, it causes divorce. So you're probably wondering, what in the world did my sermon title have to do with anything that we talked about today? Well, there's an old song recorded by, I believe it was Rupert Holmes in 1979. It's called the Pina Colada Song. It's actually called Escape, parenthesis, the Pina Colada Song. And if you've ever heard it, you know it, because it's one of those kind of earwormy songs that when you hear it, it sticks with you. And unfortunately, it was in a movie that my son Jackson likes and got the soundtrack to and has played on repeat. And if you thought the Frozen song was bad, if you like Pina Coladas, Getting Caught in the Rain, play that on a loop for a while and see if you don't tell everybody your secrets. But the song is kind of weird. The song talks about this wife who puts in a personal ad in the paper looking for a liaison, looking for someone to have an affair with. And the story goes, the song goes, that the husband of the wife sees the ad and he thinks, well, I like pina coladas and I like getting caught in the rain and I like all these things that she's describing. And so he takes out his own ad and then they decide to meet together. And well, you probably know what happens. They meet and they realize that what they were looking for, what they were longing for, could be found right where it always was. The trap of lust is it tells us things that just are not true. It looks good. It looks like it'll be fulfilling. But I love how that one writer said, it's a thirst that can never be quenched. When God commands us to keep our marriage vows, he's saying it's because each of you is so valuable, made in my image, loved, right to be together. In other words, he would say, it is good. May we go this week and treat others, all others. Let's raise the value. Let's raise the price that we put on others' souls. And let's treat each other first as souls before we ever think about treating somebody as just a thing. May God bless you. And thanks for joining us this morning.